Hiya, Niall. Welcome to another episode of In Your Nature podcast.
Yep, it's great to be doing another one, Ricky. Looking forward to this one. Really important topic I think we have lined up for everyone today. The In Your Nature podcast is produced in partnership with the Heritage Offices of Laois and Offaly County Councils, supported by the Heritage Council and the Department of Housing, Local Government and Heritage. This podcast is edited by Anne-Marie Kelly.
Yes, so we're talking about species reintroductions. So really exciting. I mean, it's a really important thing that can be done for in certain contexts, and some absolutely massive charismatic species been involved in species reintroductions in this country. So plenty to talk about.
Yes, because of course, being an island here in Ireland, we're at a bit of a disadvantage when it comes to natural recolonization, as has happened in many mainland European countries where animals like wolves and so on have been able to naturally recolonize and spread, and the same with many birds of prey. Here in Ireland, it's a bit different because obviously that barrier, the water that surrounds our island, means that lots of animals won't cross that. So it's obvious that ground-based animals like wolves aren't going to come back, or wild boar by themselves. It might stand to reason, or people might expect, that lots of birds would fly back in, but particularly when it comes to large birds of prey, they're very reluctant to cross water, and so they need a bit of a helping hand, without question.
It's an essential tool in the conservationist sort of toolbox, I suppose, when it comes to getting them back, because as you say, some just are not going to arrive on their own steam for whatever reason it might be it mechanical or otherwise. But you can't just sort of go over to Norway and grab a box of eagle eggs and throw them on a cliff in Wicklow and hope for the best. There's a bit to it.
There certainly is. I mean, you have to first of all look at and address the reasons why those animals went extinct in the first place, because that's one of the core tenets of any kind of wildlife reintroduction campaign. You have to identify the reasons for the extinction, and you can only then reintroduce the animals successfully once you're sure that those problems have been addressed and that they won't recur. We know quite a lot about why our big birds of prey, like our eagles and our red kites and so on, went extinct. It was because of human persecution. It was because in a less enlightened era, people would shoot and poison them because incorrectly they feared that they were a big threat to livestock or even to human life, which is something that we now know is not the case. And in fact, these apex predators at the tops of their food chains have a really important role to play in our ecosystem. We're missing out in a big way by not having them. So we know that's the reason why these declined. It's different for some other species that have declined or become extinct indeed because of habitat destruction or disappearance. So a good example of that would be the capercaillie, this huge turkey-like member of the grouse family that used to be found quite widely in Ireland. But they require dense woodland, particularly with a good amount of Scots pine in it, and huge tracts of undisturbed woodland habitat. And that just doesn't exist in Ireland anymore. So if, for example, someone was to try bring capercaillies back in, you could put thousands of them out in patches of woodland, but they'd never survive, or they wouldn't go on to reproduce because the conditions just aren't right. We need to replant those forests, and so that's a big long-term situation, a big long-term goal. But when it comes to the birds of prey, we know why that happened. It was entirely down to human activity. So that human activity can be reversed and changed, and attitudes changed, then the time is right to bring those birds back in. And that's what we've seen with the reintroduced birds of prey in Ireland now in recent years.
Absolutely, absolutely. And you mentioned it. I mean, the community is a big part of it, and the sort of community almost, I suppose, allowing for these animals to come back, because there has been issues with poisonings and shootings and all sorts of stuff. And we're lucky to have an interview with Alan Mee, Dr. Alan Mee, who was the sort of project manager with the white-tailed sea eagle reintroduction for the Golden Eagle Trust a number of years ago. And sort of we go into a lot of fine detail now about how that was achieved and carried out, and a really exciting project. So we'll go over to that interview now. So this morning we're talking species introductions. Delighted to have a very experienced ornithologist and wildlife conservationist of 40 years here with us, one of the driving forces behind the Golden Eagle Trust, the man who quite literally rewrote the book on the Californian condor, Alan Mee. Dr. Alan Mee, how's it going?
Hi, Ricky.
There's not too many sort of people of that experience and calibre in this country, and with great projects behind you. So really interested in getting stuck in and chatting about that. So I suppose the first question for me is, how do you go from Limerick to California and reintroducing one of the most sort of charismatic, the largest land bird in the US? How do you go from Limerick to that? It's crazy.
Yeah. It's a funny one, all right, Jen. It is a bit of a long story, but I'll try and shorten it a bit because, of course, you know, I suppose I growing up in Ireland and left Ireland in the early 80s, and I started working for RSPB in the Highlands in Scotland for quite a few years. Did lots of little bits and pieces, jump ship for a couple of years to do photography in Scotland. Then I spent the 20s thinking, because I didn't have a degree. I'd left a leave insert. So I spent the 20s thinking I'm too old to go to university, you know. And then went to my, when I was 32, to Glasgow, because they had a very good ornithology unit in Glasgow. And I kind of knew, having worked there, I'd known some of the, in fact, some of the lecturers at the time. So I knew it was a good place to go. And so I did that, and then became an eternal student. And decided after 4 years in Glasgow, I wanted to do a PhD after that. So another 4 years were tacked on, you know. It became so long that when I'd come back home to my father, who's a farmer, you know, he'd ask, how's the job going? And I'd tell him, yeah, it's going grand, yeah. I never bothered to explain that I was still a student after 8 years, you know. But after that, then that gave me the opportunity, I suppose, you know, because I'd worked on a number of research projects with RSPB, but you're the assistant, you know. We love doing those work, but, you know, after 6 months contracts moving all over the country, it starts to wear thin after 10 years, you know. So I guess I wanted to do some of that myself, you know, which was the driving force for doing the PhD. But then I just applied. The postdoc in California just came up in, I remember it was in Nature magazine. It was just around the time of the millennium, so they actually had 12 postdocs all over the world, including, you know, stuff in China on golden monkeys and all these enigmatic species. So I just applied and got an interview in California and got this postdoc, which was unusual because it was a 5-year postdoc as well, you know. So, and it was all field based, you know. So which is brilliant, you know.
You're one of the heads behind the Golden Eagle Trust, which is just to qualify for people, as the is an environmental NGO that's remit is to reintroduce and to conserve, I suppose, regionally extinct birds in this country. And up to now, focusing on golden eagles, white-tailed seagull, and the red kite, of course, is one of the big flagship ones. And then looking at cranes and other bits and pieces too since. So it's really interesting. So I suppose my next question is, I mean, you came back with sort of beads in your hair from California and some mad ideas and sort of decided to do it here. Like, what happened, or how do you get it going? How do you get something like that off the ground in a country where it's not sort of... It's definitely not the sort of a done thing, or it hadn't been till then.
I was in a position where I didn't really have to get it off the ground. Really, all the donkey work for the white-tailed eagle reintroduction was done by people like Lorcan O'Toole, with you know, the general manager of the Golden Eagle Trust, who had been obviously releasing golden eagles since the you know, for quite some time before that, you know, in up in Donegal. So Lorcan had that experience behind him, and in fact, in this year, 30 years ago, myself and Lorcan worked together on the Golden Eagle survey on the west coast of Scotland. So that's kind of when we first met, you know. Although we'd met previously, Lorcan had been a volunteer up in Strathspey where I was working, and we worked together on the Golden Eagle survey in 1992. And so I guess Lorcan came back to Ireland with having worked on the red kite reintroduction, and, you know, I suppose then his thing, you know, once you've been to Scotland and I suppose worked on species like golden eagles, white-tailed eagles, red kites, you think, well, why aren't they in Ireland, you know? And it's a bit like shifting baseline syndrome, you know. When you're living here, don't grow up with eagles, large birds of prey. Well, you kind of assume, unless you read the literature, that we never had them, and then you find out we did. Just before I go, one clarification is that I'm no longer actually working for the Golden Eagle Trust, so I'm self-employed these days. But yeah, the Golden Eagle Trust have been the driving force behind those reintroductions. So
then, I suppose, talk me through, remind us of the chronology of the different reintroductions then in Ireland in the last sort of 20 years or how long ever it's been.
Yeah, so the Golden Eagle reintroduction, so it started, just trying to actually think of the date when the Golden Eagle Trust started, the Golden Eagle reintroduction started. The White Tails was 2007 to 2011, the first release, and the Red Kites at the same time. So yeah, the Golden Eagles started 2001, and they had their first, I think they had the first fledged, their first chick certainly in 2006. The first phase of that, really, apart from actually all the donkey work that goes in before it starts, because people think, you know, it's a matter of getting hold of the birds, finding a site, releasing them, and tracking those birds. But a lot of the work goes in early in those first few years, ruling out certain sites. Big thing is consultation, really, with people in the area, especially the farming community with eagles, you know. So there's a load of work goes in. So I mean, the white-tailed eagle range reduction was probably in the ether for about 10 years before it really started. And then it's a matter of getting the right combination of stakeholders or people together to drive it forward, you know. And as you know, with these things, it often does come down to one or two or three people really to be the driving force. But you need a whole, it's not even a single NGO, because the National Parks and Wildlife Service were obviously critical in all of this as well, you know. But I suppose the milestones were with the Golden Eagle releasing in 2001, you know, releasing birds over a number of years, and then you have your first hatch chick, then first fledged chick, I think, which was either 2006, 2007, the brain's going a bit rusty. But white-tailed eagles then releases over 100 birds, 2007 to 2011, and we had our first, I suppose, for me, because I knew the population fairly intimately, was the first pair in 2010, which 3 years after you release your first birds was kind of amazing, you know, that happened quite quick, because when you release birds and then you have the bad days where you're picking up dead birds, you know, poisoning kicks in. We discovered poisoning was a real issue. If we didn't know it before, we certainly did then. And people will always wonder, well, you know, why you're releasing those birds to be poisoned. But I suppose the light at the end of the tunnel was establishing a viable breeding population. So we knew before, maybe we were thinking 6 years down the line, we might have our first breeding pair, you know. But within 3 years, we had a pair. And our first nest was in 2012 in Mount Shannon in County Clare on Loch Derg, and then the first fledged chick was the following year. So it actually happened in the great scheme of things. It happened quite quickly, you know.
Like 100 birds sounds a lot, but from, I wouldn't have a clue. Like, I mean, like, what is the carrying capacity? Like, how many birds do you have to throw into a population before it even thinks about becoming sustainable? Or
yeah, well, there was some population modelling done before the reintroduction started by Alan Fielding in Manchester University, and looking at the various scenarios, I suppose, you know, releasing different cohort of birds in any 1 year. This was thought to be the best strategy, releasing maybe up to 20 birds a year over 5 years. Should 100 birds should be enough to sustain a population. Now we know, because luckily we were, pinging on the back of a lot of the knowledge they'd already built up, especially in Scotland with the reintroductions that started in 1975. They had first phase in 75 to 85, then the next phase 92 to 96. So they needed a second release of birds because the population was kind of staggering along, maybe at three or four pairs, producing a small number of chicks, and it really wasn't really kickstarting, you know. The trouble is, I suppose, when you release a small number of birds, 100 birds does sound like a lot, but say you release, we know that birds are really, really big travelers, you know, they disperse after release throughout the whole country. We've had at least 7 birds go to Scotland, and one of the original release birds in 2007 actually settled in Scotland and is breeding in the west coast of Scotland. So we knew we were going to lose some birds, you know. Obviously, survivorship was a big thing, and on average, you tend to lose about a quarter of young birds in the first year, which is quite a high attrition rate. You know, and then you're going to lose some sub-adults and adults. So you've got to have enough. You need to have a critical mass, really, to establish
and
a population.
Am I right in saying most, if not all, the birds came from Scandinavia?
All from Norway, yeah.
Yeah. Is there an sort of built honing instinct that did any of them end up back home? Or was there a sort of northerly sort of procession?
yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, that the looking at, because we initially, the birds that were released, 100 that were released, we put VHF radio tags on 90 of those birds. And GPS satellite tags on 10. And the VHF tags are much, much cheaper so to put on birds. So, you know, you couldn't put satellite tags on every bird, even if you wanted to. They're so expensive. They were literally, you're talking about $3,000 to $4,000 per tag, you know, as opposed to maybe 120 to 150 sterling for one VHF tag. But they're only useful for tracking on the ground. You know, you physically have to go out and track the bird. So once they leave the release area, unless you're driving or have a access to a nice plane you can fly over half of Ireland, you lose track of those birds pretty quick. So the satellite tags are worth their weight in gold because obviously the birds, anywhere they go on the planet, you can track those birds. So we know that several birds have gone to Scotland. In 2008, one of our release birds went two-thirds of the way back to Norway. So it went all the way to the end of Westray and Orkney, which is kind of funny for me because I was looking at the maps and these things where it was going to go. And my first RSPB job was on Papa Westray on the island of Orkney in 1986. So it was kind of like, geez, I know where this bird is spending the night, you know. And if you measure it in a straight line northeast to Norway, that bird was two-thirds of the way back to Norway. And undoubtedly, the North Sea, the big expanse of sea, was enough to put it off. And it spent 8 months away and came back to Killarney, you know.
Cool, that's a good story. Tell me about the obstacles to the reintroductions and to their, I suppose, to their establishment and just getting on with it, I guess.
Yeah, I guess the big obstacle really, as you know, over the years has been, especially in those early years, was poisoning. So the birds were released in 2007, 2011. And because, of course, they don't have their parents, it's not a natural situation. You know, you don't have a single pair where a bird leaves a nest and the parents are looking after them. There's a kind of a period where after they fledge, where the chicks are still dependent on the parents. So really, in that scenario, we were the parents. So to get them over that period, a vital period after they take their first flights, we provided food for them around in Killarney National Park. And that worked really well. So we tended to feed for a few months, maybe up to September, October, and the birds would start to disperse. But I suppose what you find with when you lease, say, 20 birds in any one time, that is an unnatural situation because, you know, in the wild, you're talking about one or two birds dispersing from any one area. And white alleles are very social. So unlike golden eagles, they really, really, the youngsters are quite happy to roost together. So, you know, I used to check roosts when they disperse in Kerry, and you could get 12 birds in one roosting together, you know, coming out at night, which is an amazing sight, yeah. The downside to all that is, you know, a bit like vultures, you know, because vultures are so social, you know, they use a lot of vultures as cues to find food, is that if you have a poisoning incident, you know, you're likely to take out more than one bird because a young white eagle, because they're so dependent on carrion at that stage, because they're not really adept hunters at all. People kind of think, oh, it's this big bird. They're fantastic hunters. Fishing is a real skill, you know. So to become, they try it, but they're most often not successful. You know, they're built for soaring. So that, I suppose, led us into the situation where, you know, the first birds in 2008 and then started to pick up poison. And that time, as you know, up till 2010, Ireland had a derogation from the EU to continue the use of poison, so for the control of foxes and crows. So again, I suppose one of the other maybe misperceptions at the time was when we were starting to find dead birds was that this was deliberate poisoning of the birds. And I would say 99% of the cases it wasn't. You know, over the years, we got to know a lot of the farmers pretty well. And I would say it's tradition, really, that, you know, they had put out certain poisons for foxes and crows. It wasn't in the mindset to think, you know, that, well, there's going to be collateral damage, you know, that you could get other species that would be taken out, because undoubtedly, even pine martens around Killarney could be taken out by poisoning as well. Or it's so indiscriminate, you know. Any other birds like ravens. And we'd often thought of, I suppose one of the things we'd thought maybe is, you know, if there are good numbers of ravens and hoodie crows out there, well, that's probably an indication that there isn't a lot of use of poisons. And we probably found that they're not really that good a surrogate for as an indication that poison is or isn't out there. Some of it, I suspect, and I think there's been some kind of recently something about foxes in that case as well, where foxes were actually, they could detect really which carcasses to avoid. You know, I suppose it smell, if humans had been to a to a down carcass, you know, put poison on. Foxes were probably suspicious, you know, of that, and maybe over time, some sort of selection pressure, you know, they were avoiding those. It looked like really ravens and hoodies and all those weren't really a good indication that poisoning is necessarily out there. So unfortunately, we did find out the hard way. The good thing was we had those birds with transmitters on. We were able to locate them fairly quickly, establish the cause of death. And really, I suppose that really was the turning point to kind of pressurizing government to ban these, you know, and to stop the use of poisons, you know.
Thank God that gained the leverage. Tell me this, would you say the population of white-tailed eagles and golden eagles is established and sustainable now?
I'd say not. No, I would say... you probably heard that there is National Parks and Wildlife Service are releasing some more white-tailed eagles now, started last year. So they're managing that second release of birds. And we kind of always had that in mind anyway, based thinking back to the Scottish situation. We were a bit like that too, because we started our breeding started in 2012, first fledged chick in 2013. And then I suppose the next milestone for us with the white-tailed eagles was an Irish bred bird joining the breeding population. So we had a female that started to breed in 2020. Yeah, she was an original Mount Shannon bird from 2014. So she came back to breed, actually, sorry, 2015. And she came back to breed in 2020. That pair now, in two breeding attempts, they've fledged five chicks. Two last year and three, which is amazing, and kind of, I suppose, confirms in our mind how you know, the quality of the ecosystem, you know, where the birds are breeding, that the like Loch Derg, such high quality that this is probably you know, the birds have shown us probably where the birds are really going to do well, and where the population is going to expand is probably along the Shannon catchment. You know, I suppose, like, looking at the Scottish situations, we got to that situation where we had an Irish wild-bred bird joining the population. We then were kind of stuck, a bit like the Scots. Maybe we were stuck at maybe 8 to 10 breeding pairs. And then up to 2018, the trajectory of the chicks, number of chicks, was going up. We were up to 7 chicks a year being fledged. And it looked like, you know, it was really going well in that. And then 2018, avian influenza hit. Avian influenza took out our two breeding pairs on Loch Derg, the two most productive pairs. So most of our productivity was gone straight away. And, you know, it that kind of reinforced the idea of maybe bringing some more birds in, because with a small population, you tend to have all your eggs in one basket, if you know what I mean, you know. It did seem a bit of a no-brainer. If there was a possibility that the population wouldn't have enough birds out there to become viable, you know, why not release some more birds, you know? So I think those birds will become a vital boost to the population in over the next 2 or 3 years, because we now have a situation. We're stuck on about 8 to 10 pairs, and we have some unpaired birds, which it doesn't look like they're going to pair up, just because, you know, there aren't enough birds out there floating around that find them. So we've had birds that lost a mate. Say we had you might remember there was a pair up in Connemara, Star, that lost his mate in 2015. Unfortunately, she was our last confirmed poison bird, and she was found dead on the nest with eggs inside her, which was tragic. After that, he never paired up. And it was, all those things are kind of tragic. And that reinforces the idea, you know, we just didn't have enough birds out there, because once they reach adult stage, even those unpaired, most of them stay on territory or stay locally. They don't really float around the whole country looking for a mate, you know. So so I think the new addition of new birds the population should be viable with that addition of new birds, you know.
Brilliant. That's really promising. And we're always encouraging people to get out and see birds and enjoy them and enjoy the spectacle. So can you, and obviously it's very vulnerable species in this country because the numbers are so low, but can you recommend any areas or times or ways that people might connect with sort of the large raptors and white-tailed seagulls in the country without sort of disturbing them in any way?
It's always a funny one with, I suppose, any rare breeding bird, you know, was big or small, is most of your locations where they breed, you just keep them confidential. And that was the idea when the birds first started to breed in the wild, and then we just happened to have our first pair started to nest right in front of a town, County Clare. In those situations, we decided there's absolutely no point in keeping that under wraps. The thing was to bring the local community in Mount Shannon on board, and really they took the project on. And that was a great model for the future, you know, where birds breed in these local areas, that it's not that the local community takes hold of the project and drives it forward after that. And
that was handled so well, and it was policed locally, and there was a bit of tourism off the back of it, and it was really, yeah, really positive thing.
Yeah. So I would say Lough Derg is still a good place to go, even though that male lost, you know, he lost his mate in 2018. There is actually signs that he might be pairing up again after 4 years as a widower. So hopefully Lough Derg will come back on as a good place. But probably the best place of anybody, Glengariff is, you know, we have a pair in Glengariff. They're well known, publicized. We had a webcam on the nest a couple of years ago. And, you know, the boatmen know where the birds are. And, you know, they can also avoid taking people anywhere too close to the nest that it disturbs the birds. So that's a really good place. And obviously Killarney as well, you know.
No, they're really good tips. Listen, Alan, thanks a million. That was really good chat. Brilliant insight into how it's all done and how it's been going. And it's really exciting stuff. Yeah, thanks a million.
Thanks, Ricky. Thanks a million.
Yeah, so there you go, Niall. Like, I mean, a lot of detail there from Alan about how you sort of reintroduce apex predator back into a landscape after an absence of 100-200 years. It's complex enough.
It really is. There's a lot more to it than a lot of people would realise. Because as you were saying earlier, it's not just a matter of getting a whole lot of eagle eggs and just turfing them out somewhere and hoping for the best. A whole lot of groundwork has to be done, a lot of monitoring, and a lot of dedicated monitoring and conservation work by a whole lot of people. You know, the international governments and government agencies and many people making this happen. And of course, central to all of that is local communities and the attitudes of local people and their desire to protect these birds and to see them coming back into our skies. Because here in Ireland, we have a real scarcity of large birds of prey. We really stick out like a sore thumb in a European context because of that, even compared just across the water to Britain, where we see far more large birds of prey than we do here. They're a really important part of our ecosystems. It's really important to have them back. And it's really good to see these birds back in their rightful places in our skies. Some of the reintroduction campaigns have been more immediately successful than others. you know, birds like golden eagles, there's challenges facing them in terms of food availability. The white-tailed eagles, they seem to be doing pretty well. You know, they are spreading. They are starting to be seen now more and more. Once you get to the point where the birds are successfully breeding in the wild and then their offspring are going on to breed, you know that you've got these natural behaviours starting to return. And I think that's really important as well. And certainly in Birdwatch Ireland, we're finding more and more people ringing us up to report, like with awe and wonder, having seen these great birds. You know, go back 15, 20 years ago, people would be ringing up to say, I've just seen a big bird of prey, a buzzard or something. It's awful. It's going to kill my children. It's going to eat my cats. What am I going to do? And now 99.9% of the calls and the messages we get are really supportive. And the other 0.1% that we get in, a lot of those people actually, our job, I suppose, is to help to change their minds and to help them realize that these birds aren't the threat that maybe they might have been seen as. It's something that an attitude certainly that is rapidly changing across Ireland. Obviously, there's still issues with wildlife crime. There's still illegal killings of birds of prey, which is atrocious to see. It's just appalling. But when that does happen, I'm quite heartened to see that there usually is a public outcry. This is seen as something that's terrible or a blight or a reason for shame in a local area. And to see local people rallying in support behind these birds of prey, particularly the reintroduced species, is really good to see, I think.
Yeah, no, absolutely. No, definitely there's been sea change and it's really exciting. One of the introductions by the Golden Eagle Trust was really, really quite quickly very successful. And I think we'll dedicate Bird of the Week to this species. And that's the red kite. They're absolutely phenomenal bird. I mean, kite, I suppose, called a kite because their flight is so, kite-like and so fluid and beautiful. And they're an amazing animal, this kind of large, gingery bird with a forked tail. And this sort of, you can see the sort of fingertips, if you like, in their outstretched wings and sort of a white head. They're a really phenomenal bird. Tell me about them and where we can see them.
Well, I'm very lucky living here in County Wicklow because I see them now very regularly, because County Wicklow was one of the three sites where this species was originally reintroduced back into Ireland using donor stock that came to us from Wales, where the population was clinging on, really the only place in these islands where those birds had survived. I think the population in Wales actually went as low as one female. So all of the kites we see now in Ireland are descended from one female, which is really amazing. It got that low. But they made a big resurgence in Wales to the point that the bird became quite common in some of the valleys. And we knew that they would be genetically closest to the birds that used to be found in Ireland, and so they were primed to be brought back in and to be reintroduced here. The nice thing about red kites is that, unlike most other birds of prey, they're very tolerant of humans. So we think of birds like golden eagles; they tend to avoid people like the plague. They stay as far away from us as they can up in remote areas. Red kites will fly over towns and villages. You see them along the roadside, and it's really amazing to see such a large bird. I mean, the wingspan of well over a metre. They're bigger than a buzzard. And to see these birds just drifting slowly through the countryside, they have these, as you said, these forked tails. They're very long. They keep twisting them when they fly. It's a very distinctive looking bird, one of the easiest birds of prey to identify. And to see these back now in the skies over Wicklow here is absolutely brilliant. The other reintroduction locations, there were North County Dublin and also in County Down. And the thinking behind that with the Golden Eagle Trust and the National Parks and Wildlife Service in their reintroduction campaign was that ultimately these birds would breed in the wild, and hopefully then the three populations would link up in a natural way, strengthening the genetic stock and so on, and then would move across the rest of Ireland. Now, the spread has been quite slow away from the east coast, but slowly but surely these birds are spreading. You know, it's a bird that would once have been extremely common in the Irish skies. We know a few hundred years ago this was a common bird in urban dumps and flying over people's gardens and going through rubbish tips and so on. And they actually perform a really vital role in the ecosystem. They are scavengers, like vultures would be. And that's not a bad thing. That's a great thing, because they're cleaning up all the dead and decaying animal matter and that could cause disease in the countryside. It's just a mystery to me as to why people persecute them in the first place, because they're a completely harmless bird. They look big and imposing, but they're actually real softies. They really don't hunt all that much, and they wouldn't take much bigger than a rat even if they did. So they'll do that occasionally, but they prefer just to scavenge on already dead food if they can find it. So yeah, great to have them back.
Excellent. Yeah, they need a bit of forestry as well. So and probably plenty of dead sheep and lots of forestry in Wicklow is what probably has become such a hotspot for them, I guess.
Yes, a lot of the Wicklow countryside is very similar to the valleys of Wales, where they're thriving now again, and where their ancestors came from. And we've also seen reintroduction campaigns for this species across other parts of Britain as well. So Wales has been doing well, but they've been reintroduced into many parts of England now, where they're thriving as well. And we're also seeing a resurgence of the species in countries like Spain, where it had become quite thin on the ground, where the numbers are bouncing back. It's one of very few birds that's almost completely confined to Europe, as it happens. A lot of our European birds also occur either in parts of Asia or in Africa or migrate, but the red kite is almost completely confined to Europe, so it's virtually a European endemic, so one we should be particularly proud of. They occur nowhere else, so particularly vulnerable from that point of view, but really good to see them coming back. And certainly now here in Wicklow particularly, a lot of people have got to know them. The landowners are incredibly supportive of these birds. Everyone knows that they're a great advantage to have around. They're not harassed. They're not bothered by people. And they do very well. And one of my favourite things to do each winter, I always go to the village of Avoca in Wicklow, which is where Ballycus Angel was filmed. So you still get the tour coaches going from Britain to see that site there. But the best thing about that village to me is if you just stand on the bridge there and just wait, just before dusk, you will see many, sometimes even dozens of red kites just flying overhead and coming to roost in the trees on either side of the valley there. And it's absolutely breathtaking to see so many large birds of prey in one spot. I never thought I'd see that in the Irish skies in my lifetime.
No, fantastic. It's beautiful. No, it's really, really, really worthwhile once in the winter to go do that in Avoca, and it's a lovely place anyway. Let's just listen to the audio quickly so people know what they're listening out for. It is quite a distinct sound as well.
That's it, all right, yes. And, you know, not the most intimidating or imposing of sounds. People often think that birds of prey would sound really gruff or fierce or tough. But no, the kite sounds very pleasant, I think. It sounds, as I said, it's a bit of a softie, really. Nothing to be frightened of. A really good bird to see back in our skies. And I love hearing that sound myself now in Wicklow.
Yeah, no, it's great. So it's, we talked about the three main birds of prey that have been reintroduced in the country. And of course, we'll talk, I think, a bit more in another episode about cranes, which looks like they've found their own way back, at least a little foothold now. So we'll talk a bit more detail in the future about that. There's grey partridge, of course, that there's a reintroduction programme in Bura, but it's kind of a little bit stuck, I suppose, in an island population because the habitat surrounding it isn't suitable for them to make a spread, I guess. So there are teething problems and there are issues. It's not just sort of always that straightforward, but We will hit on those species in a future episode, I think. So nice one, Niall. That was great.
Well, just as I always like to finish, you know, if you've been interested enough to listen to Ricky and I prattling on about birds for the last while in this podcast, we would love you to join Birdwatch Ireland as a member, because we're a charity. All the money we raise through our membership goes to support our conservation work, monitoring birds of prey and helping to protect them, as well as a whole suite of other species and wider biodiversity. So if you go to birdwatchireland.ie, you'll find full details there. And you can also buy it as a present for any friends or family who you think might be interested. It's a great gift because you get our magazine Wings that comes out to you throughout the year, Bird Detectives, our kids magazine, a lovely welcome pack with full of posters. And best of all, you get to know that you're really helping to preserve those birds for future generations. So birdwatchireland.ie for all of that.
That's great. And the In Your Nature podcast is produced in partnership with the Heritage Offices of Laois and Offaly County Councils, supported by the Heritage Council and the Department of Housing, Local Government and the Heritage. This podcast is edited by Anne-Marie Kelly.